If I were a superstitious person, I'd almost hesitate to say this out loud, but I am among the lucky few people left on the planet who has not had a COVID-19 infection, at least as far as I'm aware. I've taken the recommended precautions, and I'm very much in the pro-vaccine camp. So once those shots became available, I didn't worry too much about getting seriously ill. But long COVID? Yeah, I really don't want to experience that. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The CDC now estimates about 1 in 5 U.S. adults who catch the virus end up with at least some of those lingering symptoms from COVID. Fatigue, shortness of breath, sleep problems. Those are all easy to understand. But some unlucky long COVID patients also suffer from a deeply debilitating additional symptom known as brain fog. This one has been harder for scientists to understand and harder for doctors to treat. But make no mistake, it is absolutely real. And what it does physically to the brain is downright disturbing. Ed Yong covers science as a staff writer at The Atlantic and won the 2021 Pulitzer Prize for explanatory reporting. His recent article about long COVID was titled, "One of Long COVID's Worst Symptoms is Also Its Most Misunderstood." Ed, welcome back to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me again.
Before we get into today's conversation, I do want to let Think listeners know about an event we just announced this morning. I will be having an onstage conversation with Chef Tiffany Derry. You might know her as a contestant on Top Chef. The event will be held Friday, November 11th at Four Corners Brewery in Dallas. Tickets are available at our website, think.kera.org. I would love to see you there in person. All right, back to our conversation with Ed Yong. Thanks for your patience on that, Ed. To start with the basics, how is long COVID different from the initial acute infection with COVID?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, from the start of the pandemic, people were told that COVID is an infection that either is severe enough to land you into a hospital, forcing you to require extra oxygen just to breathe, putting you in an ICU, or it's mild enough that it goes away after 2 weeks. But there is a vast hinterland between those extremes, filled with people who got past the acute phase of their infection, often without ever needing to see a hospital, but have nonetheless been debilitated or disabled by long-term persistent symptoms. These symptoms are many and varied. They can affect every possible organ system. They often wax and wane. You've mentioned some of them, and one of the most common that we're going to talk about today is brain fog. Now, this somewhat nebulous term makes the condition a bit easy to misunderstand, but brain fog is actually something very, very specific and is also found in a lot of other conditions that aren't long COVID. What it is a problem of executive function. And that's the set of mental abilities that include focusing our attention, blocking out distractors, and holding information in mind. Now, if it sounds to you like those things underlie basically every important thing that we do, then you're right. They are completely foundational. And if we lose executive function, we lose the ability to do a lot of really, really important things. Driving becomes impossible because people forget their destination along the way. Reading becomes often very hard because people can't hold on to the meanings of words over the span of a sentence. People have told me that even something as trivial as unloading a dishwasher can become absurdly complicated because just the process of identifying an object, remembering where it goes, and then holding that in mind until you actually can put it there is too hard. This is obviously a massively debilitating thing. It is really common to the experience of long haulers, people with long COVID, and it is often misunderstood. One of the most common things people with brain fog hear is that, oh, you know, it's just like, yeah, it's like tiredness, it's like stress, you know, I'm sleep deprived too, I can't multitask either, yada, yada. None of those common experiences come anywhere close to matching the severity of the experience that people with brain fog are experiencing.
So this is not like losing your keys and not feeling very motivated. This is a different thing. What did actual patients tell you it was like for them?
It's horrible. It runs the range, right? So there's a wide range of different presentations. Some on the mild side, some on the severe side. Like in some of the severe cases I've heard, like people can't read anymore, people can't work anymore. Like anything that involves concentration, planning, multitasking becomes just fiendishly complicated. Buying food at a grocery store, making choices, remembering where things are in the aisles, then preparing that food for yourself, following a complicated step-by-step recipe, all of these become excruciating. And because executive function is also tied to memory, a lot of people experience memory problems too. The memories are there. It's not quite like dementia or other neurodegenerative conditions of old age. It's more that if without executive function, the brain can't focus on the right things to store and then can't efficiently retrieve those memories when needed. So a lot of people suffer from what feels like short-term memory loss. They lose their stories of themselves, their personal narratives, their sense of identity. They forget really obvious things like names and places, and it really can feel like dementia, but it does have this sort of different underpinning. As Hannah Davis, one a long hauler I've spoken to, said, it feels like I am a void and I'm living in a void.
I was struck by the person you spoke to that said, to this question of identity, she was studying theoretical physics before. That was who she was. For now, that kind of brain power eludes her. And so I don't know if she set it aside entirely or if it just doesn't feel like the right career path anymore.
And so to be clear, as I said, brain fog is common to a lot of other conditions, including other post-viral ones. So conditions like myalgic encephalomyelitis or chronic fatigue syndrome, ME/CFS, affected millions of people before COVID came along, is very, very similar to a lot of long COVID, and also comes with brain fog. And this is what the woman you're talking about, Fiona Robertson, had. She first got sick in the year 2000 and has had brain fog ever since then, for now coming on over 2 decades dealing with this. She was studying theoretical physics at university, and after she got sick, lost that ability. It's heartbreaking to me. She said, I used to sparkle, like I could pull these things together and start to see how the universe works. And I've never been able to access that sensation again. And I miss it every day like an ache. That loss of identity can be absolutely profound, especially for people who work in professions that prize brain power, surgeons, healthcare workers. I mean, a lot of people working in both blue collar and white collar jobs. That inability to think erodes away your sense of who you are. And I think that that's always compounded by extraordinary amounts of dismissal and a lack of empathy from the people who really should be extending that to folks who have brain fog. One of the most common things that I hear from people who experience this is my family doesn't understand. My friends tell me I'm just being like dramatic or lazy. Like my doctors think I'm making it up. Like imagine going through this level of disability to the extent where basic tasks are excruciatingly hard, career options fall away, like things that once brought you joy and purpose are diminished, only for everyone around you to tell you that you have no problem and are making stuff up. Like that's almost the worst of it. It's that meta level of indignity that layers on to the actual physical experience of the symptom.
We have never been great as a society at believing people who suffer from invisible health problems, and it probably doesn't help here that more women than men seem to experience brain fog as a symptom.
Totally. I think that is a major part of it. There has been a long history in the medical profession and in society in general of trivializing and dismissing women's pain, like billing women as being, quote unquote, hysterical or overly emotional, or psychologizing their pain, saying that their real, very real physical problems are just the result of a mood disorder like depression or anxiety. You're right that a lot of the conditions that lead to brain fog, from ME to long COVID, disproportionately affect women. Some of the conditions that can lead to brain fog also affect people who have been marginalized and neglected, including epileptics after seizures, cancer patients experiencing what's called chemo brain, a lot of people living with HIV. There are many groups of people who have been experiencing this for a very long time, and it is not a coincidence that many of those groups of people are stigmatized and marginalized. I think if that wasn't the case, we would have a lot more to say by way of explanation or offer by way of treatment to people who are going through this now. But we're limited in that, and that's partly because of this unacceptable social stigma born of ableism and misogyny.
As I understand it, Ed, women also tend to be more susceptible to certain kinds of autoimmune disorders. Could those
Sure.
same mechanisms be playing a role here?
Yeah, I think that they are certainly connected. I think the way to think about this is that there are a lot of complex chronic illnesses that basically travel in packs. They overlap a lot in their symptomology. Probably they overlap a lot in their root causes. A lot of them disproportionately affect women, and a lot of them come with symptoms like brain fog. I've talked about ME/CFS, we've talked about long COVID, there's also dysautonomia, fibromyalgia. A lot of autoimmune disorders fall under this bracket too. So it's not this is very much a long COVID thing, but it's not just a long COVID thing. There's this entire cluster of largely neglected medical conditions that a lot of medical professionals have never talked about, and therefore know nothing about, but that affect millions of people in the US alone who desperately need help and, at minimum, like just some validation that what they're going through is real.
And yet, because of the stigma, it's possible that some patients sort of mask these symptoms when they visit their doctors.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. And this is really important to understand. It's not it Okay, so in some severe cases, the brain fog never lifts. It's just this heavy presence and people can't go about their basic lives. In a lot of cases, it waxes and wanes. So people might have good days and people might have bad days. And on the bad days, you don't see them. They're not doing interviews with journalists. They're not going to doctor's appointments. They are sitting at home being cared for by loved ones, or trying to eke out the basics of daily living. So it's very easy to there's something about the way the illness affects people that makes it a bit invisible. There's also the fact that you can push through if you want to, and we should talk more about why that's a bad idea after the break.
Ed, you were saying it is possible for some people to really pull out all the stops and push through a bad day of brain fog, but this can be really detrimental, can it?
Yeah, it can be incredibly detrimental. We've talked about the social stigma that comes with this problem. And because of that, and because of our ableist attitudes, a lot of people feel compelled to present as normal in doctor's appointments or in social situations. But that can be really, really bad for them. So one of the other really common symptoms of long COVID and the hallmark symptom of ME, common to a lot of these chronic illnesses, is called post-exertional malaise. And that means after even minor physical or mental exertion, you crash badly, and all of your other symptoms get considerably worse. So often what happens is people with brain fog try and push through the brain fog. They try and be normal. They try and go back to work. They try and be their best selves when they hang out with their friends. And then they're just wrecked for hours, days, maybe even longer afterwards. And that's the cost of the stigma, I think. You're pushing people into actually quite dangerous situations because they're trying so hard to, and they're told so often to just like force their way through it. And if you have post-exertional malaise, you cannot, and it will make things a lot worse.
I was really surprised to read, so often for a number of mental health conditions, exercise has been proven to be just about as effective as medication. This is not the case for people with brain fog. Physical exercise, working out, can also make you worse.
Sure, and just to be clear, it's not true of like everyone with brain fog. It's true in many cases because of this overlap of brain fog and this other symptom, post-exertional malaise. But you're right. The very common received textbook wisdom is exercise is good, and in many cases, probably most cases, that is true, especially for a lot of brain health stuff, right? Like neurodegenerative problems. But this ain't a neurodegenerative problem. This brain fog comes often hand in hand with this other symptom for which exercise is the wrong thing to do. Or if it's done, it needs to be very carefully managed and considered. So people in these patient communities often talk about pacing. So just very carefully sensing and managing your energy levels so you don't have a crash. This has been a bone of contention in this space for a long time. Like exercise therapy used to be recommended as a treatment for ME/CFS because of some shoddy science. And patient advocates and other scientists have fought very hard to change that and been pretty successful at it of late. But I think that idea that there's a group of people whose symptoms mean that exercise can make things worse is still not widely recognized. And still a lot of long COVID clinics are pushing people to exercise, and I think risk harming their patients as a result.
What do we
And
know?
to be clear,
Oh,
so wait, sorry, one
continue.
more thing. Just to be clear, I don't just mean physical exercise, I also mean like cognitive exertion, because ultimately it's the same thing, right? The brain guzzles down energy. And if you're doing hard cognitive work that often people do when they try to push through brain fog, it will have the same effect as like doing, intense physical exercise.
Does brain fog affect kids who have long COVID in the same way it affects adults?
As I understand it, yes. Although I haven't done the in-depth reporting I would want to do to answer that question fully, but like in the main, yes. I just haven't particularly spoken to either parents of children who have this or pediatricians who treat children who have this.
Okay. What do we know about the observable physical effects on the brain of people who have brain fog as a symptom of long COVID?
Yeah, I'm great. I'm really glad you asked that because, as we've said, there's a lot of, I think, unfair skepticism and undue disbelief about this as but it's very clear that brain fog involves genuine, tangible changes to both the structure and chemistry of the brain. So there was one study, for example, which looked at brain scans of people who had been infected by the coronavirus and who'd been taking part in the study even before the pandemic. So they had before scans of what their brains used to be like. And the study showed that infections with COVID can slightly shrink the brain. Like it can reduce the thickness of the gray matter, the part that's rich in neurons. And these changes are relatively small, but at the worst in this population, they were equivalent to a decade of aging.
Oh,
And
wow.
this was the case even for people who weren't hospitalized, so who have quote unquote mild infections. And also, those changes were accompanied by cognitive problems. So we can already see that there are structural changes. And then there are chemical ones too. So there was a really interesting study recently showing that that was focused on mice, but has some corroborative evidence in humans, which showed that You have a mild COVID infection, and inflammatory chemicals travel from the lung to the brain. And there they disrupt this group of cells that normally support the neurons in the brain. They normally like do cleanup, that prune away unwanted connections. They do like custodian work. But if they're inflamed, if they're in this inflammatory environment, they go rogue. They start destroying things. In their presence, a part of the brain involved in memory produces fewer new neurons. Existing neurons lose the insulating coats that cover them and that allow electric currents to efficiently move along their length. These are the kinds of changes that one sees in people with other conditions, like chemo fog, for example. And they make total sense of some of the experiences that people have, who people talk about, those who have brain fog. Like one really common thing is people feel that their processing speed is shot. Like it's like their brain feels sluggish. But that makes total sense if the conductivity of their neurons is actually lower because they've lost some of that insulating covering. Like a lot of the basic science and the people and the patient experiences actually cohere really well. And one last thing I'll say about this, like there's probably lots of different mechanisms at play here, right? So there's the inflammatory stuff I talked about. You mentioned autoimmune effects earlier. There's also the fact that COVID affects blood vessels. It damages them. It fills them with small clots. That means that the blood supply to the brain and other extremities is throttled. And because the brain requires so much oxygen and fuel, if you have less blood going to it, it cannot fire on all cylinders, which again perfectly explains why people with brain fog experience the problems they do. If you have less oxygen going to the brain, the most high functioning and oxygen demanding mental functions will be the first to go, like executive function, which is basically what brain fog is. And that also explains why people have like good and bad days, right? Like if you have like a good night's sleep or more rest, you'll be better. You'll have your baseline will be a little bit better than if you can't sleep, which is also a very common experience of long COVID. So there are lots of environmental factors that interact with these more biochemical pathways that, and together they already do make quite a lot of sense of the very, very real and very debilitating things that patients are talking about.
Okay, I want to go to the phones. The number is 1-800-933-5372. First up on the line in Frisco, we have Aravind. Hi, Aravind.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to know, like in the case of like long COVID or any such illness, brain fog post such illness, there is a cause and effect. But it seems like the symptoms are pretty much overlapping with the general attention deficiency. But how do we really differentiate between a brain fog and attention deficiency, if there is any?
Thanks for calling.
I take my answer offline. Thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah, that's a really good question because attention deficit, ADHD, also includes brain fog as part of it, right? Like it, or some version of it. It also is fundamentally a problem of executive function. And what I've heard from a lot of people who have both of these problems, so long COVID or a similar chronic illness and ADHD, is that their experience of these two conditions is different qualitatively and quantitatively. So one of the women I spoke about had earlier, Hannah Davis, told me that she had ADHD for a long time, and what she's experiencing now is much more severe and different in the way that it affects her thinking. I've heard from others since the piece was published who've said, for example, that like the directionality is different, that they're both executive function problems, but ADHD can sometimes feel like like your executive function is all over the place. Like it's sort of, there's sort of too much going on. And the brain fog experience is more of like a universal dampening. Like it's hard to it's almost impossible to sort of push your way out of it because everything just feels sluggish and slow. So I would feel I would need to do a lot more reporting on this specifically to answer this question with any kind of authority. I'm just sort of talking about the general types of things that I've heard since doing this piece. There very much is an overlap, but I don't think it's like entirely the same, if that makes sense.
Ed, how are neuroscientists trying to get a handle on what the specific mechanisms of this might be and why they're caused by this virus, but not all viruses?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I've talked about a couple of the possible explanations. The neuroinflammation route, the lack of oxygen and blood flow to the brain. There's the autoimmune explanations. It could be that the infection is reactivating dormant viruses like Epstein-Barr virus that we know can also cause neurocognitive problems. There's a lot of possible explanations. It feels likely to me that many of them are correct, and that a lot of things are going on here to explain the varied features of brain fog. And as I said, that this is not new. It's not like this is a problem that emerged in the last 3 years. It is also common to a lot of other post-viral illnesses, and a lot of other conditions that don't stem from infections. I think that it's likely that there are common like biochemical mechanisms, like pathways, origin pathways that explain all of this stuff and why brain fog is so common to people with a wide variety of problems. But as we've said, one of the reasons that we don't have clearer answers is that a lot of these conditions have been marginalized and stigmatized. I think that if some of them are correct, so for example, if the neuroinflammation idea is correct, that is a good-ish thing in that it suggests that the symptom is potentially reversible. So if brain fog was the work of, say, a persistent viral infection in the brain, or if it was the result of the infection killing off neurons by depriving them severely of oxygen, that would be a different matter. That would be difficult to undo. But the idea that that it might be caused by things like neuroinflammation suggests a potential reversibility. That's not going to be realized unless a lot more people do research on it, on this problem, and treat it with the kind of seriousness that it deserves.
I think you and I have talked about this question before, but it's been a while and the science is changing so rapidly that I want to ask it again, Ed. Are scientists concerned that a COVID infection, between 2019 and 2022 could rear back 20 years from now and cause some other health problems that we don't even know about yet?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's, clearly, we have ample evidence now that an acute viral infection can lead to a chronic illness, right? That's why a lot of people have ME/CFS. It's why a lot of people have long COVID now. I think what you're asking is something slightly different, though, like whether there could, that sounds more like whether there could be like a latent, whether the infection can go latent, right? Whether you could
Chickenpox
have a
shingles,
virus.
right.
Totally, right. Could that possibly be true for COVID? I don't know. I really don't know. The long-term consequences of an infection that has really only been around for 3 years are very, very hard to predict. I do know that there are people specifically looking into this question. So there is a new group called the Long COVID Research Initiative that's comprised of some really amazing scientists, immunologists, ME/CFS researchers, long COVID clinicians, who are really trying to get to the bottom of this specific question, like, does the virus actually persist in the body? Do those potential reservoirs have anything to do with the symptoms of long COVID? I think that's a truly fundamental question that deserves a lot, like some intense research efforts to answer. And it does seem as if those efforts are actually happening, which I am certainly reassured by.
Ed, to the extent that a term like brain fog, which is the common term for this condition, sounds a little squishy, sounds a little not real, is anybody talking about coming up with a more official sounding term for this?
I've heard a lot of clinicians and a lot of patients argue that this is part of the problem, right? Like that the term sounds so colloquial that it almost invites dismissal, and that calling it, and then it doesn't come close to capturing like how severe the problem is. So some people, talk about cognitive dysfunction or or like more polysyllabic medicalized names. I do very much sympathize with this. A lot of conditions do get taken a bit more seriously if they get like a more hoity-toity sounding name. But I do also want to point out that a lot of folks in the disability community have noted that brain fog is a thing, is a term they have used a lot for a lot of the conditions that we've talked about that cause this symptom. For there are many good reasons to actually still use it, according to this line of thinking. Like, firstly, and very obviously, it's just simpler to say, right? Like, if you have brain fog, it is easier to talk about brain fog than it is about like post-COVID cognitive dysfunction or something of that kind. And also, like, it's sort of inclusive, right? It's encompassing, and it. Part of this argument is that the reason people dismiss and ridicule brain fog isn't just because of the name. Like, if you gave it a complicated name, it's not going to suddenly or magically make everyone treat it seriously. It's not like myalgic encephalomyelitis or fibromyalgia or dysautonomia suddenly became like mainstream diseases that got recognition and validation because they have like long complicated names. Like, those are also dismissed. Like, the core problem, I think, is one of ableism rather than one of terminology.
Sleep is all about the brain. Is there thinking that the sleep problems associated with long COVID could be driving brain fog? Could they actually be a factor of brain fog, or does anybody know?
I would probably classify them as like an exacerbator. Like, it certainly makes things worse. Like, if you can't sleep, which often people can't, all of the you're going to be functioning off a much lower baseline during wakeful hours. It's just going to make that whole experience of brain fog that much worse. I think that's probably how to look at the interaction between those two things.
There are lots of different strains of COVID. Some of them appear to have a tendency to make more people more severely ill. Is there work to determine whether particular strains might be more or less associated with long COVID and therefore brain fog?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think really the most important answer to this is that they all can, right? Like, it's not that we've suddenly had strains that don't cause long COVID. There are people who got sick during the Omicron wave who are dealing with this now, despite all the hoopla around about that strain being quote unquote milder. Like, it really isn't, like, in most ways. And I think especially when we're thinking about long COVID, like, typically when people talk about the severity of a strain, they're really talking about like the risk that people will get hospitalized or die. But as we've already discussed in this show, you can get the symptom after having never been sick enough to need an ICU or even a hospital visit. Like a lot of people who have long COVID, a lot of people who have brain fog, never needed a hospital, but are now debilitatingly ill anyway. And I think that speaks to how little we actually understand about how a viral infection can harm people's health. Like we think about the acute stuff, right? We think about the effects on the lungs and the respiratory symptoms, but all the rest of it, which can be incredibly severe, doesn't sort of fall under that rubric of severe, and just gets ignored.
What do we know about whether or not vaccination has an effect on the likelihood that you will develop long COVID?
So there have been a few studies on this now, and in the main, it does seem that vaccination reduces the risk of developing long COVID. I don't think it reduces it by a ton. Like certainly, vaccines are extraordinarily effective at keeping people out of hospital and out of the morgue, right? They're very, very good at preventing hospitalizations and deaths. I do think that they reduce the risk of long COVID. I don't think that is anywhere close to a guarantee. So, as just one example, I learned last weekend that one of my friends, who very much is fully vaccinated, now has long COVID symptoms, and can't work as a result. And I think that the country has been fed, sold this bill of rights that once you're vaccinated, you can tap out of the pandemic problem. You don't have to worry about this. And I don't think that's true. Like you can worry a little less, but I am still concerned. I'm still concerned for my own health, for the health of my loved ones. I have some security from knowing that I am now quadruply vaccinated, but that security is not, a surefire thing. And I think that the thing that really gets me about this is we're told. We have been told by this current administration and many big influential voices, wrongly, I think, that the pandemic is over, that if you're vaccinated, you can relax, and that if you any residual risk is your own to manage, that it's all on individuals to look after themselves. But then, if all of those things fail and you get sick and you don't get better, what you can look forward to is to spend years of your life with people telling you that you aren't sick, that you aren't ill, with people dismissing and downplaying what you have. And I think that is, I almost, I don't actually have words to describe that. I think that, I think it's a travesty.
What do we do? This seems to me to be another problem of oversimplification, right? The administration wants people to be vaccinated. Overall, that's a net good. We'd be better off, globally if more people were fully vaccinated. Therefore, the message comes out like, get vaccinated and you can go back to, licking telephone poles and whatever. I mean, you're a science communicator. What can you suggest about the ways to get these messages across that are nuanced but not too complicated and still communicate the sort of action that experts hope most people will take?
Well, Kira, I've been trying. Sorry, well, Chris, I've been trying to do that for the last 3 years with mixed success. So, I am as frustrated about this as anyone. What I will say is that one consistent problem we have had is to turn everything into a dichotomy, like two binary extremes. So either it's mild or you're going to die, which completely ignores this like vast land of disability in the middle, or it's vaccines fully protect you and you never have to worry about anything ever again, or vaccines don't work. Whereas, in fact, vaccines work really, really well. They just can't hold the line on their own. And I think that this black or white thinking leaves us completely unprepared to deal with the many shades of grey, which is almost entirely what the pandemic is about. It's all about that middle ground. And I think that we ignore the middle ground for all the reasons that we've talked about. People with long COVID, people who are immunocompromised, people who are grieving loved ones lost to COVID, a lot of the people who I've spent time trying to report on fall into this sort of no man's land. They feel abandoned and ignored by all of this, the pandemic is over rhetoric. And it's another tragedy, I think, that some of the people who've borne the biggest burdens of this should be the people who receive the least amount of attention right now.
Ed, there are medications that help people with, let's call them congenital executive function problems, like people with ADHD. Do stimulants work to help people with brain fog function better?
I mean, so sometimes they might help, and I want to be cautious here because I don't want to sort of talk about all stimulants. So for example, like one person told me that she works better on caffeine, like caffeine helps, but it's not like that's a cure, right? It's a bit like the having a good night's sleep that we talked about, and also there is a wide range of presentations here. So some people, probably a small proportion, get better on their own and recover close to baseline. Some people do not get better. Like I've spoken to people who have been sick since the very start of 2020, at the very start of the pandemic, and are no better. If anything, they're a little worse. Talk to people who've been sick with brain fog for like decades now. So some people do not get better and are very severely ill. In the middle, the most common presentation, like the average patient, is someone who does improve, but not back to where they were. Who, through a large number of mitigations, compromises, and life hacks, regains the ability to have a relatively normal life, but at cost. Like everything is slower, it takes more effort, it requires much more recovery. So, I've talked to people who have regained the ability to read, who couldn't read before, but who still can't go back to work. I've talked to people who can go back to work, but have to sacrifice like literally everything else. They don't have the energy to work and socialize, or who can work, but it just takes like five times as much time as before. Like even simple tasks like planning a calendar or sending an email, they have to write down every single step and then follow it through in order when previously it was just an unconscious natural thing. And I think that's something that gets missed in this discussion too, just the deterioration of a lot of people. There are absolutely people who've been severely harmed by this and who have lost their careers, much of their lives. But I want to point out that even in the quote unquote milder cases of brain fog, you're still losing something. You're losing ability, you're losing potential, you're losing some of that identity that people hold dear. And when that combines with the sort of stigma and ableism that we've talked about, it makes for a really bad combination. It makes the experience of brain fog so much harder for people to wrestle with.
I wonder if we'll start paying closer attention to this when millions of people start filing for disability.
I mean, God, I hope so. But let's a couple of things on that. Firstly, if you have executive function problems and you can't concentrate and you struggle with like multitasking and planning, filing for disability is really hard. I mean, I am a non-disabled person, and having to deal with any kind of American bureaucracy is already like almost beyond my capability. Like imagine doing that when you don't have the ability to pay attention to things or to follow complicated steps. And then, disability, like it's not easy to get on disability. Like a lot of people struggle to do so, even because this symptom is so misunderstood and so stigmatized and so disbelieved. So
We're going to have to jump in there. I'm sorry, we're out of time. Ed Yong covers science as a staff writer at The Atlantic, won the Pulitzer last year for explanatory reporting. We've been talking about his article. One of long COVID's worst symptoms is also its most misunderstood. Ed, it is always nice to talk with you. Thank you for making the time for us.
Yeah, thank you for making time for this topic.
Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.